This podcast is supported by The Real Real. You know what I love most about the holidays? Giving gifts. But not just any gifts. Real gifts. Thoughtful gifts. Oh my God, how did you know gifts? That's why I love gift shopping with The Real Real. The Real Real is the most trusted name in authenticated luxury resale. And it's a holiday shopping secret I'm going to let you in on. Whether it's a surprisingly affordable pristine condition bag for your BFF, a vintage find that's cool enough for the Gen Zer in your life, or even something your impossible to shop for dad will love. Get used to saying, I found it on The Real Real. Seriously, with over 10,000 new arrivals dropping every day from brands like Gucci, Fendi, Prada, Louis Vuitton, Tiffany & Co., and Cartier, there's guaranteed to be something for everyone on your list. Oh, and did I mention that everything's up to 90% off retail?
Get $25 off your first purchase at TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com to get your $25 off. TheRealReal.com.
In this week's episode, I'm joined by Eric Pothan. Eric is a certified eating disorder recovery coach and an eating disorder advocate who serves on the peer council for the National Eating Disorder Association and the Community Engagement Committee for the National Association of Anorexia and Associated Disorders. After struggling with an eating disorder for several years, Eric now uses his lived experience to raise awareness and support others on their recovery journeys, particularly around eating disorders, disordered eating, and body image, with a special focus on men. Eric is currently pursuing a degree in counselling at St Mary's University of Minnesota with the goal of becoming an eating disorder therapist, specialising in working with men and the LGBTQ+ community. I really enjoyed this conversation with Eric and discussing our shared lived experience as well as how we both now use that in our work. I really hope you enjoy this episode.
Well, first of all, like, how are you doing?
Yeah, I mean, that's really polite of you to ask. But yes, I am very well, thank you. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing pretty good.
Good, good, amazing. Yeah. Well, I'm just going to take us straight in from there because you did a very nice little how are you. So that's a lovely way to start. So did you want to introduce yourself to the listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. So my name is Eric Pothan. I am living in the state of Minnesota in the United States, so across the pond. But what's interesting actually is I feel like I've connected with a lot of folks over in your part of the world, which is really amazing. I am an eating disorder recovery coach. Prior to that, I was a middle school choir teacher for 7 years. So,
wow.
Yeah, so teaching and youth still hold a very special place in my heart. And right now, this past fall, I started studying for my master's in counseling to become an eating disorder therapist. So very excited about that as well.
Yeah, that is really exciting. And I think it's so lovely. I've met so many people who have a career change, you know, maybe later in life to become a therapist. And it's often interesting the career that they've come from, because as you say, you know, they're working with the youth and teaching and stuff. Those sort of skills do then translate into things like therapy. So that's very exciting for you.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, and I think there's a lot of similarities between teachers and therapists, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting what you said about talking to a lot of people this side of the world about eating disorders. And it was a conversation I was having with somebody the other day, actually, in that I think in the UK, we do have a lot of research on eating disorders happening. And someone said to me, is it similar in the States? And I didn't really know, but I don't know whether you would have any insight on that.
I think the research is happening in the States, but I think the biggest thing that at least I'm experiencing and you know, being in communication with folks, you know, on the other side of the world is it feels like eating disorders, I mean, yes, there's still a lot of stigma surrounding them, but I think a lot more conversations are being had surrounding eating disorders on your side of the world. And I think there are just a lot more eating disorder activists, too, in your part of the world, where here, I mean, sure, we do some activism work and some awareness and advocacy, but I think, you know, seeing some of the huge walks that you all do over there and, you know, like the breaking of the scales, I think they occur here in the US, but you don't hear much of them in a way.
It's really interesting because I think, I don't know, maybe I'm thinking because the US is such a larger scale, if those things, you know, the UK is basically like one state really, isn't it? If you think about the size of it. And I do think, you know, within our community, I think, you know, the UK eating sort of community is incredible. Like I'm so glad to be part of it, and I've made a lot of really great friends through it, and I think there's a lot of discussion and support for people. But outside of the community, I think we are building awareness, absolutely, and it's thanks to people like Hope that do the Dump the Scales campaign and the people that work with her that that's happening. But I wonder, because it's a smaller country, do we maybe hear about it more? And then in the States, because it's so big, I don't know, I mean, we don't have to get political. not sensible.
Yeah.
It just feels like there's a different agenda, I guess, yes. In America.
Yes. Yeah. And I think too, I mean, where my mind goes is, you know, maybe it's happening here in the States, but people aren't posting and talking about it in a way. And so I think just the overall visibility is really important in this work, especially for, you know, more walks and sort of other campaigns, right, to raise awareness. I just don't think, and I think too, going back to your comment, I think this does kind of, we can follow that string and rope to the political side of things, right? Like, where does eating disorders and that lie on the political agenda when we have, you know, a government that is focused on, quote unquote, making America healthy again? And focusing on the obesity epidemic and certain things like that. So, you know, I think you were onto something though in saying and mentioning the political side of things as well.
But that is really interesting in itself because, you know, our health secretary basically said that he wanted everybody to be on weight loss medication for the same reason of tackling the obesity epidemic. And, you know, there's been reports of people saying, you know, every single member of parliament is on them. So it feels like the similar things are kind of being said and happening. But I do think that, you know, potentially there's an element of things that people feel comfortable speaking about and being open about and kind of saying, you know, what they're part of. Maybe people just feel potentially, and I'm literally making an assumption here, but more comfortable to talk about that in the UK.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I think too, there's progress being made. I don't want to negate any of the progress, but I think there's a part of me within that's like, why can't we make this change happen quicker?
I guess moving away kind of from the political aspect of it, I'd be really interested if you're happy to share a bit of your personal experience of, you know, what happened with your own eating disorder.
Yeah, absolutely. So my eating disorder developed shortly after I graduated from college or university. I was really sad about graduating. I had met some of and made some of the best friends I've ever had in my entire life. College was such a positive experience for me in comparison to a lot of my other educational experiences growing up. So there was sadness surrounding not being around my friends. There was stress and anxiety with becoming an adult and starting your first real adult job. And then I was also really struggling with my identity, more so my sexuality at that time in my life as well. And so I think for me, that was the perfect storm. It's like, you know, if you think about a building block tower, it's that last one that you put on where it's like, oh, it's getting kind of topsy-turvy, and then it falls. And I just feel like it was a combination of those three things that really led to the onset of my eating disorder. And then it kind of transitioned, or the way that it continued to go was I got really into exercise. I was beginning to overly engage in compulsive exercise, started to naturally lose a little bit more weight because I was just engaging in more frequent levels of movement prior to when I had, before I graduated. And then that's when the comments started rolling in from other people of, oh, you look great. Have you lost weight? Have you put on muscle? And we all know what those comments can do, right? For someone who may be struggling with food, eating disorders, or body image. And so then that led me to engage in even more excessive and over-exercising. I then somehow realized, oh yeah, if I also control food intake, that will help me get the body I want better and much quicker. So that's when those two worlds had combined. And so I lived with anorexia for a number of years. And it had gotten to the point where my parents were like, Eric, if you don't start to put on weight, we're going to schedule a doctor's appointment for you. And I was just like, no. That's the last thing I want for me right now. And so that really left me with two options. One was go to the doctor, and they would probably have made me go to residential where I would receive care for my eating disorder and be labeled of having an eating disorder. I think that's the interesting part is when I was struggling, I don't know if there was just like denial in a way of like accepting that that's what it was that I was struggling with or what.
Did you feel like you were struggling with anything or were you kind of like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, I think deep down. I knew I was struggling with something, but I just feel like if there was shame attached to it of like saying, oh, I'm struggling with an eating disorder, that like kept it suppressed deep down in a way. But yeah, I think I did know. But once again, it's like when you are so immersed in your own little inner world, right? When you are connected with that eating disorder voice, that you just feel as one with the eating disorder. And you have such a hard time of being able to zoom out and separate yourself from the eating disorder to even recognize that something is maybe not normal going on with food and eating and just the changes in your physical body. And I mean, that makes sense to me in a way of, you know, I would always look in the mirror and the eating disorder voice would tell me like, oh, you need to lose weight. But had I been able to separate from myself and maybe name that, oh, what I'm living with is an eating disorder, it would create enough separation for me to see that I literally had like no more weight to lose.
Do you think the shame came from the way that the eating disorder was making you feel, or was it the fact that you were struggling with something? But it sounds like, I don't know, correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you didn't really like rationalize that you were struggling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you're right, it's that rationalization part. I think there was shame around admitting, or I don't like to use the word admit because that has such a negative connotation, right? Of maybe a word that I like to use is embrace, like embracing the fact that I was struggling with something much bigger and much deeper. But I also, it feels so complex in a way. I also think too, very deep down, there was also this recognition too of like, well, you're a male and males don't struggle with eating disorders, or so that's what I was really taught and what's reinforced within society. So then you have that piece to the puzzle as well. And so I think for me, it's several pieces that maybe contribute to that whole feeling of shame. And also, I think there's this stubborn part in me that doesn't like to be wrong. And so thinking too of like, okay, well, if people are coming to me and saying that things are a problem, honestly, like the taking ownership part has felt challenging for me in a way. But then I think it's the taking ownership that can elicit those maybe feelings of shame and guilt. So even in the actual process of owning and embracing, shame is still attached.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And I think, you know, what you just described there is such a perfect description of how it's never just one thing. It's not just one thing that triggers an eating disorder or makes you feel bad and therefore you have the eating disorder. It's an amalgamation of so many different things, and probably so many things that you've not even mentioned, because they might have been little things that happened in life or things that feel uncorrelated. So I always find it really interesting, like the things that people have picked out from their journey as to what kind of could have led to that. But actually, as you've pointed to, you know, those emotions of shame, you know, that I think is what keeps it going, because it's that emotional kind of bit underneath that drives you to keep engaging in those behaviors. Because realistically, anorexia is a horrible illness to live with, but there's something that keeps us going and keeps us kind of leaning back into those behaviors.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, even hearing you say that, another thing that has come to my mind that I feel like I've never really reflected on too was in one of my classes right now, it's developmental psychology. So you're really learning how your social interactions, your environment can influence the way you develop and the way you think about things. But my mind even went to, well, what was really taught to me by my parents was also this notion of like, don't be a burden, don't ask for help, because then you're making more work for another person. And we were told kind of just take care of yourself, do the best you can, and don't become an inconvenience for another person.
Mm. Yeah. And, you know, I think that is so common. And I don't know whether this kind of relates to you, but I know for me, a big thing that I found was that people pleasing nature. I had, you know, a similar experience to you in the fact of I engaged in exercise, I lost some weight, I started getting positive comments from people. So it's almost, in effect, that's the people pleasing as well, because you're like, people are giving you positive comments. So that feels like you're making them feel good. But equally, by keeping everything inside, you're not burdening other people. So you are being the perfect child or the perfect friend or whatever, because you're dealing with your emotions in your own way. It's not until things get a bit too far, and then actually you can't be any of those things because you're so engulfed in the eating disorder.
Yeah. And I want to add to that too, because I think that people pleasing component definitely was a part of my journey. And also, I think what is attached to the people pleasing is this need for external validation. And so once again, in putting on my like developmental psychology hat, I can trace that directly back to my childhood in the way that I was raised, in a way of like, you need to be the best to receive kind of that attention or praise. In anything that wasn't first placed or an A would be met with disappointment. And so I also think the people pleasing and that need for external validation, they're really close neighbors in this conversation. And I think that that can be true, I think, for, you know, those that do struggle with eating disorders, right? The eating disorder thrives off of validation, whether it's from the scale, whether it's from a photo you take of yourself, whether it's from getting a compliment from another person. It's looking for things in the external world to provide validation and praise for it wanting you to engage in the behaviors it's wanting you to engage in.
Yeah. But I think, I don't know whether you'll have the answer to this, but it was just making me think as you were talking. That makes so much sense to me in the start of an eating disorder, because you're engaging in the behaviors, you know, you lose a bit of weight, you still quote unquote look healthy, therefore you're getting that external validation. But you kind of, you know, you mentioned and I guess pointed to the fact that you lost a significant amount of weight, which at that point, you know, without me being rude, people do look unwell. So, and it's not something that is glorified or people desire. So do you have any thoughts about like why you continued with that way?
Yeah. And now that you say that, you know, I think maybe it's not external validations from others per se, but I still think the eating disorder looks to our environment and our external world to receive that validation in a way. So it might not be from others, but I do think there are certain things that, you know, the eating disorder becomes attached to that continue to fuel its behaviors in a way, because the eating disorder loves control. And where does it find control? In our, well, of course, within us, and in the way we carry ourselves and the actions we take in our external worlds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I wonder as well if, and I guess this is speaking from my own personal experience, but that kind of positive reinforcement that you get from the comments that you receive from people, or the feeling that skipping a meal or doing a workout gives you, each time you do that, you need more of it to feel that same. So I wonder if there's an element of that in that, in order to feel that same happiness or joy or whatever it is that you felt from it, you then need more. And the eating disorder, as you said, with the sense of control, just keeps clawing more and more and more because it's never really enough for it.
Mm-hmm. And what if we look at it from another approach too, of what if what's keeping us engaging with the eating disorder behaviors is actually fear of disappointing others for when our body does change?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because if you've received all those positive comments when you're smaller, what's going to happen when you're not that size anymore?
Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, and I heard this too in my own recovery, was when I started to regain weight, was like, wow, you're starting to look healthier. You look good. Well, that just made me want to re-engage in all the ED behaviors,
mm-hmm.
right? And so then, of course, that's what the eating disorder tried to latch back onto. Once again, needing that like validation and needing to people please, like in the external world, right? It's really interesting to me to think about that. And then part of me was like, well, okay, well, now I don't want to disappoint others. But this is where I had distance between myself and the eating disorder, mm-hmm. right? Where it's like the rational mind was back online and it was like, okay, well, now I can't disappoint others because now they're starting to see that I'm moving in the right direction. So I need to keep walking on this direction. I think that's where that perfectionism part snuck back in. And so perfectionism in the rational mind versus in the eating disorder mind, it just, they look so different, mm-hmm. right?
Mm. They look so different, but I think can be so similar still.
Yes.
And I think it's a very common thing to slip into the perfect recovery rather than the perfect eating disorder. And actually, both of them are inauthentic to you and potentially aren't going to be the most supportive of your future.
Yes, absolutely. And I think, you know, in the coaching work I do now, that a lot of the clients that I have this very fixed idea of what recovery looks like. And I think the biggest hang up, and the same is true for me in my own recovery, is once again, control. Control is very present and was very present for me in my recovery journey, was the need to be able to control the way your body looks as you begin to restore weight.
Mm.
And that's the hardest thing for a lot of clients to hold space for themselves internally, and to be like, wait, what? I can't do that? I'm saying you can do that, but you're going to find it's a lot more challenging to be able to truly heal yourself of, you know, maybe the values you give to food and movement, right? Because even just thinking of like, okay, I need to be able to control the way my body looks as I restore weight. Well, what are the two things that we know that can contribute to that? Food and movement. So it feels really hard to sever that connection or relationship that the ED has with those two things, food and movement, when there's still that really close attachment with yourself in those two things as well. So needing to almost redefine what food and movement actually mean to you as an individual outside of it being two things that contribute to the way your body can look.
Mm. And I don't know whether you have experience, you mentioned that, you know, exercise became something that you did struggle with, but I hear so often people really finding that balance really challenging, and it can be very easy to slip into, okay, I'm weight restored and I'm eating, but still being very restrictive in food choices or the amount that you're eating or the exercise that you're engaging in. But because it's so glamorized in society and you look fine, it's kind of seen as okay. Did you have any experience of that?
Yes, absolutely. And I think for me, it's something that I like to be mindful of, even being recovered for 8 years from my eating disorder. I feel like this is the best place I've been in with both food and movement. And I think for me, it's recognizing and just being more aware of when the eating disorder voice is popping up from time to time, and reminding myself of, okay, what is the recovery oriented action I can take in this scenario, right? Because of course the eating disorder would feel like the easiest route to take in a way, right? It's the thing that's going to make that distress and discomfort go away the quickest. But it's choosing that recovery oriented action and moving with that discomfort of like the voice still being present. Maybe it's not full blown at 100%, but because you're taking that recovery oriented action, maybe it's like a 70% recovery oriented action, 30% eating disorder voice, because it's still going to be, still going to be there, right? That's why it can feel challenging for folks to choose the recovery oriented action, because even if they do that, the voice is still going to be present. Mm-hmm. And it's, how do you learn how to dance with that? In a way, like it takes two to tango, we say. And so how do we allow and give ourselves that trust in a way that I can dance with the voice, but I'm going to be the leader of the two of us and Ed can follow.
Yeah. It's really interesting you say that, because I was speaking to my therapist this week and I got diagnosed with ADHD last year. And so I found kind of navigating exercise to be quite challenging, because it does help me regulate my emotions. But I think sometimes I very much lean into it of like, oh, I'm doing this to regulate my emotions. And actually it's coming from an eating disorder place. And she was saying about how climbing can be really good for people with ADHD, because it's like full body muscle stimulation, which can be really good for like sensory overwhelm and stuff. And I said, yeah, but I've tried climbing before and I still make it compulsive. And she said, but we will do to start with, because your natural response when you're exercising is to make it compulsive. But you have to kind of keep reminding yourself that the reason you're doing this is because of the emotional regulation. And then if you do it and you experience that emotional regulation, then you can kind of start to shift your mindset. And it just made me realize that like it reminded me what you've just said, like the eating sort of voice won't just disappear tomorrow. And sometimes you'll do stuff and it will be there and you'll think, oh my God, just go away, I don't want you here. But I think it's about like relearning those experiences to be for other reasons, whether it's connecting with nature, doing it with friends, what have you. Initially, it might feel disordered, but showing yourself that it cannot be disordered. You have to be honest with yourself of, am I doing this to help myself or to hinder myself? Obviously, I'm not saying like you can go to the gym and, you know, pound yourself to the ground and be like, oh no, it's just because of emotional regulation, because you're not actually experiencing emotional regulation in that sense. So yep. I think that honesty piece, but kind of relearning it as well, can be really useful.
Yeah. And I think too, in hearing you say that, it's almost like a reframing, and very much so with the example you gave of like, okay, this used to be compulsive, but I'm learning how to have a different relationship with it, because my intention and reasoning for engaging with it is maybe aligned with how to provide yourself some self-soothing when you're overstimulated with your ADHD. Right. Yeah. So I think it's that reframing, rewiring. And for me, that kind of aligns with what I talk with my clients too, is in those moments, yeah, it might feel really hard, but there's some rewiring going on up in your brain. And then you'll be able to tell yourself like, wow, I did that. That feels really empowering for me, because that's a recovery oriented action. And it's those little wins that begin to add up for you internally that help build your confidence and trust in self to move forward the next time you might feel activated, the eating disorder voice gets online and tries to get you to engage in a behavior, right? Mm. So it's these little things can create such a positive effect on the inside that helps you move forward in recovery, more grounded, I would say.
Mm. I love the word that you used about intention. I think that when you said that, kind of clicked for me of like, oh yeah, it's if you have a different, you're going in with a different intention, the behavior could potentially be the same, but the intention is different. Therefore, that's kind of where that rewiring happens. So I really valued that you said. I guess because we've moved on to the topic of recovery, what did that process look like for you in terms of getting better?
That's a great question. And that was, it was really messy. It was ups and downs. And, you know, one thing that I feel like makes my recovery journey unique in a way, and it's something that I would never, ever, ever recommend to anyone now that I've gone through it is I did it all on my own. I did not receive any sort of formal help or treatment for my eating disorder. And so I feel like my recovery journey is couldn't be further than, you know, what a lot of individuals do. But that process for me, I remember the day I chose recovery, I'll never forget it. I was walking into where I was working for the summer, and I was just really tired of being in the place that I was. And I told myself, like, Eric, today's the day you take your life back. And I still get chills every time I say that sentence out loud, because it was the first time that I put me first in a number of years. It was me putting my foot down with the eating disorder. It was me prioritizing me. And so that was the first day that I let myself eat more than I had in the past number of years. And I was really, really, really struggling. And I remember thinking, oh my gosh, I don't think I can do this. Because I was like, if this is what it's going to feel like every time, I would rather stay and stick with my eating disorder. But I told myself, like, that's not an option. You've chosen this path. Yeah, it's going to stink. But deep down, I knew I had what it took. It was just like a needing to like continue to remind myself that time and time again. And so, you know, it really was step by step in a way where, you know, there were some days where I felt like I was really on track. And then there were other days where I moved back to restriction. Right. And so it wasn't like every day, yes, I'm beginning to eat more. I'm beginning to restore weight, things all sunshine and flowers. But, you know, it had gotten to the point too where I'd started to restore a little weight, but I'd hit a plateau for a short amount of time. And this is when I started to use alcohol as a numbing, as like a coping mechanism for me, in a way where I would need to consume alcohol to relieve myself of that fear and anxiety surrounding eating food. And so that was a part of my recovery journey that it feels heavy when I think about that. I mean, I wouldn't consider, you know, when I was struggling that I was an alcoholic by any means, but I definitely depended on it. For sure, as a crutch in a way to really allow me to move forward on my journey, but not have to deal with the mental side of things. So just almost like putting a Band-Aid on it. Mm. I found my way through that, luckily. And then I started to struggle with chewing and spitting, which I don't think is talked about often enough in the space of eating disorders. And once again, it's a very hidden behavior. So individuals don't know to look for that in a way. But I couldn't tell you the amount of money I spent on desserts and sweets to, once again, allow myself to maybe experience the tastes of some of these things that I hadn't eaten in a number of years, but without having to ingest those. Once again, it was very messy, but I somehow found a way through that. And what feels really ironic to always share at this point in my story was what really helped me find solid footing in my recovery was actually registering for a marathon, which feels so right. I have the same internal response, right? But for me, I think where I found that to be really helpful was I told myself, like, Eric, if you're going to be setting out on this training block to run a marathon, food and nutrition is going to have to be number one. And so it was then that for the first time in the X number of months that I had been in recovery, that I put two and two together of, oh, if I just allow myself to eat three meals a day plus snacks, I won't have this like need to binge or overeat or anything like that. And it seems so simple to say out loud, but for me, it just felt like, where's my Nobel Peace Prize for like having this discovery? And since that moment, I'm just like, that's the importance of food. Like, not only is, I go back and forth with how I feel about the phrase food is fuel, because that is very true. But I think it's the context in which it's used, right? if it's going to be used in a way to like normalize the over-exercising or certain things like that, then I think it's important to maybe reflect on it. But food is fuel. Absolutely. Mm. I've used it in my own recovery journey. It really aligned with me at that point in my recovery journey. But once again, I just feel like I have become more aware of the language I use and that is used and just what that can do to an individual's mindset in the way that certain things are approached or normalized or validated in that way. But I digress. So it was really that point where I was starting to train for my marathon, and that was the first time in I don't know how many months where food, yes, it still created stress and anxiety for me in a way, but I feel like it was a lot easier for me to maneuver the mental stress because my body had the actual nourishment. My brain had the nourishment to be able to work a little bit more harder in those moments and to be able to tap into that mental resiliency as well.
I have so many questions.
Go for it.
I guess so many questions and so many things that I resonate with. What you said about, I feel like it's very contradictory to say that one day you wake up and you say you're going to recover from your eating disorder, but genuinely that was my experience too. And I feel like I find that difficult to say because I feel like it really minimizes people's struggles because I'm like, you just need to basically have a day where you realize that you want to recover. And I don't mean it like that at all. Like I literally had anorexia for 14 years. I know that that day doesn't come for a very, you know, and I don't also want to say to people it's not going to happen for 14 years. Mm-hmm. But I do think that something clicks in your brain and it's like, shit, this is it. Like I'm going to do it today. And in a similar respect, I have a similar journey to you in terms of like, you know, different behaviors coming in and then becoming the new behavior and stuff like that. But what I really want to ask you about is the marathon, because I also have a love-hate relationship with the term food is fuel, because part of my recovery was finding powerlifting. And so I was basically then eating because I had the excuse of I need to eat because I'm a powerlifter. So did you experience anything like that in terms of I need to eat because I'm doing my marathon? And then after the marathon, what happens then?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know if I remember far back enough to think about headspace throughout the rest of the marathon training. But I will say that that's where the eating disorder voice likes to slip back in for me today is in terms of movement, right? The days where I take rest days, the eating disorder voice is probably the most loud for me, right? Because in a way there has been, especially in the past, right? And for me, I think every time I have these kind of like aha moments, I always like to use the phrase like, oh, well, that makes sense. That makes sense to me, right? Mm-hmm. And it makes sense that it would show up in this setting because when I was in the depths of struggling, those two were so connected to one another, right? When I was over-exercising, of course, that still influenced the food that I was going to eat on that day and the mental math that I was doing in my head of what I allowed myself to eat. And so I think that pathway, because I feel like that was like what I really struggled most with, is the deepest. And so for me, that's something that I think will continue to, I'm sure someday it will be less loud, right? But I know that's a journey. And it's not getting frustrated when it does get active. And once again, I tell myself like, oh yeah, that makes sense that Ed would be loud right now. But I agree, like that those two were so deeply connected that any time one is separated from the other, something's going to get activated within, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, I think it goes back to what you were saying before in terms of like your intentions with it, because I absolutely find that, you know, some days I do have disordered thoughts, whether that's about food, exercise, my body. And I use that almost as like a sign now of, this feels a bit off, and it's felt a bit off for the past few days, few weeks maybe. What else is going on in my life that maybe I'm feeling a little bit out of control, or maybe I'm not really enjoying something, or I feel like I'm not quite doing something to my full potential, which then those thoughts become louder. And so for me, it's been really about recognizing that recovery doesn't mean that you never have a disordered thought ever again, but it's how you respond to those thoughts. Because back in the day, it would be straight, you know, diving back into the disordered eating. Whereas now it's like, oh, hello, what are you trying to tell me?
Yes, absolutely. And I think you really said that so beautifully in a way, because I think in all of this, especially when we find ourselves in recovery, that when those disordered thoughts sneak back into the mind, it can be a really great opportunity for us to hit pause, zoom out, and ask ourselves those questions, Hannah, of like, what else is going on in my life right now? Am I maybe feeling really stressed? Mm-hmm. And maybe that is why the eating disorder voice feels so activating and is popping up right and left. Because I think when we can go a layer deeper and ask ourselves, what is this really about? It's not about the behavior. The behavior is there because it's a coping mechanism for you to respond to something else in your life that you can't, that you feel like you can't maneuver in staying in, you know, recovery version of you. And so it's, I think that's what can feel, that's where some real healing happens. I think in some, where some really positive and powerful growth happens in recovery, is when you are able to zoom out and try and go that next layer deeper. What is this really attached to? What need of mine is not being met right now?
Because then you also develop the trust in yourself that you can recognize, that you can regulate, and you can give yourself what you need, basically, and you don't then need to rely on the eating disorder, which I think helps gradually over time. It's absolutely not an overnight thing for you to realize, oh, I don't need the eating disorder to cope with these difficult emotions or these difficult situations. I believe that I can do it on my own now.
Mm-hmm. And I feel like those were some of the biggest aha moments for me, not only in recovery, but I also think this is something that I apply to just my overall general mental health, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Of like, I'm feeling stressed right now. You know, what's lying beneath the stress? What need is it? Maybe I'm not taking enough care of myself. I'm not creating enough time for me in the day, mm-hmm. right? Because once you name that, like you said, you're better able to move forward and address that underlying need, which then impacts the way you're able to like move forward, right? It's instead of like letting yourself feel stressed and doing the thing that feels most comfortable, like, I don't know, I just keep using the phrase like putting a Band-Aid on it, right? You allow for the wound to air out a little bit and to heal, right? Mm-hmm. And not have it be so protected all the time, because eventually we do need to take the Band-Aid off in order for the wound to fully heal.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a lovely analogy. Like, you know, if you kept the plaster on forever, then it's not going to get the air to heal. So sometimes it is about taking it off. Sometimes that can be slowly. Sometimes you can just rip it off. I think it completely depends on what you want to do. And I think that's also such an individual thing in recovery, of some people will do it slowly. Some people might dive headfirst, but that is... we've all got our unique journeys. And yes. I think I've said this quite a lot recently, but it's definitely been something for me. Just staying in your own lane and recognizing it's your journey that you're on, and that's okay. Mm-hmm. But Eric, it's been so lovely to chat to you. And I feel this has been such a nice episode, because what I want to say is that often when men come on the podcast, people are like, oh, well, you know, we'll talk about male eating disorders. And yes, obviously you've mentioned that obviously you are a man and that is part of your journey, but eating disorders impact everybody. And so I've really enjoyed this conversation, that we've just spoken about our common experiences, our differences, and it's not been gender-based. I think that's just a really powerful message of, you know, eating disorders do affect everybody, and they don't affect, you know, particular genders in a particular way.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I think too, what this brings up for me is like, I feel like I always get the question of like, well, how do you support a male living with an eating disorder? And yes, gender is a part of the equation. But like you just said, this conversation, there are so many similarities, it sounds like, mm-hmm. between, you know, our journeys and our lived experience. Remind yourselves that like, we are human beings. Yes, gender is a part of who we are, but go to our own experience. Start there. Put maybe gender aside to start. Acknowledge it, because I think that's important.
Absolutely.
But once again, I think I love these conversations too. And I'm so glad you pointed that out, because that's my answer to a lot of people is like, how would you work with anyone else who came to you struggling with an eating disorder? Start there.
Mm-hmm. I think it's one of those things that it's similar to, you know, you mentioned your sexual identity. I think it's really one of those things that is important. It's an important factor and it's an important thing to consider, but it's not focus, because like, as we've said, our experience is potentially quite similar for two men, potentially extremely different situations and scenarios. So yeah, I just really wanted to point it out, because I think it's such an important thing and a conversation I've been having recently in terms of, yes, we need to acknowledge that, you know, there will be differences in bias for different genders, and there may be different experiences and there will be commonalities, but equally we are unique individuals, and ultimately in order to treat somebody and support them the best, we've got to focus on the individual.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the last thing I want to say is I think this is why it's so important to think about, for all people, the intersectionality of everyone's identity, right? So not just for men, but let's say for women, think about all the different identities that may influence, you know, the way they carry themselves, the way they may explore recovery, all of these things that I think can add up. And I think if we just start off by saying, you are a person, you have lived experience, let's start there. Let's unpack it a little bit, because I think once we start to unpack, we'll begin to see how these different, you know, elements of identity, the intersectionality of it all, will begin to unearth itself. And then that's where you can take conversation.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, honestly, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. And talking to you across the pond as well. I always love it when there's people from different countries, because I'm like, oh my God, we're going global. So thank you so much. It's been so lovely to chat.
Absolutely. And thank you so much for having me on. I enjoyed our conversation.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling, and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.